Mrs. Griffin, you told us a little bit about Morgan Chapel. Suppose you tell, start kind of from the beginning, because there's lots of people that probably never even heard about Morgan Chapel.
Well, being a Methodist, I can tell you most about the Methodist Church. And Methodism in Long Hill began in 1830 over on the Whitney Avenue, where you take the turn to go up toward Daniels Farms Road. I would think now on the property of Mr. and Mrs. Eldridge, very near to that. And that was where it started. That's long before my time, but that was in 1830. And for 25 years they met in this building. And then they moved over to Morgan Chapel. The Morgan Chapel is still in existence, but it's no longer a chapel. It's the store at the corner of Lake Avenue and Main Street, known as Long Hill Food Market. Some of you are familiar with it. Mr. Griffin bought it some years ago and fixed it over into two rents upstairs and the store downstairs. And at that time, the time he bought it, it had a cupola on it. But he took the cupola off, and so that not to have that there anymore. I don't know whether it was leaking or what, but he took it off. And so that building has been renovated to some extent. It's still in use. Well, it was called Morgan Chapel because of Reverend Morgan, who preached at the Daniels Farms place, was still the pastor there, and he gave $1,000 towards its erection in memory of his parents. And that's where it got the name, Morgan Chapel. And after Morgan Chapel was sold, the first party that bought it was a man by the name of Camp Cutter, and he had a dance hall there. That's where I came, but I've heard lots about it. And he put some very beautiful maple floors upstairs in that building. Those floors are still there today in wonderful shape. Mr. Griffin didn't have to put any new floors up there. They were in such fine shape. Then that... Yes, new church. Rather sacrilegious, I know. But that's what happened. After Mr. Cutter got through with it, it was a man by the name of Mr. Walters came in there with a garage. And he had this garage for several years. Then after that, Mr. Walters quit his garage. And Mr. Griffin bought the building and made into it the store and the upstairs living quarters that are there today. So that's where Morgan Chapel was. They stayed there. Well, Morgan Chapel, 1857, the cornerstone was laid. And they stayed in this place until 1908. In 1908, they went up to Long Hill Center to a small place there that was they used to call it the hall. It had no embellishments. It was just a square building up and downstairs. Upstairs was church, downstairs was Sunday school room and social hall. And you know, in those days, the church was really a focal point of interest in any community, much more so than it is today. And we'd have our socials every week and old folks' concerts at Mr. Sherman, I remember very well. And a lot of things that were very entertaining. And we had a good time there, too. And so that was in 1908, they went up there. And they stayed there until 1916. There's one thing that might be interesting to some of you about being there. Every Sunday afternoon, most of us, especially around the center, Mr. Sherman and his sister, Dot Beach, Merrill, and Hal French, and Elsie, and a lot of us, would take walks. You didn't have to be afraid about walking in those days. The cars were very few and far between. And we would walk and have a good time and get back, always in time to change our clothes and freshen up for church. But one Sunday we got our time mixed. We got back to the center just for church time, no time to go home and make any changes and look more presentable. So we decided, those of us that were going to church, we'd just sit in the back seat. Nobody would know, and we'd just sit there. So we went in as big as life and just sat there quietly. And we saw Mrs. Abbott, our organist, looking daggers at us. You know, we knew very well that the three of us in the choir were supposed to be up there, but we just sat there and sang the hymns and so forth. And finally, it came time for the anthem. Reverend Poulton got in the pulpit and he said, if Eleanor Sherman and Lauren Sherman and Clarice Bray will kindly come up here, the choir will sing. So much to our chagrin and Mrs. Abbott's delight, we went up and sang. That's just one amusing instance of many that we could tell you. But then in 1916, Reverend Poulton formulated the idea that we have a church of our own, a real church building. Mr. and Mrs. Nestor Wedge gave the property for the church in the location it is now located, And we went to work with Mr. Poten's help and got our church. He worked right in the ditches with the men. He was just a good old sport. And everybody just worked as hard as they could, men, women, and children. We all had something to do. We had about 70 members at that time, so it was quite an undertaking for a small group. But the church was built, and the fieldstone of which it is built is native stone here. It was brought by Mr. Housewright and the Katz boys and different people who would haul it up for us, and volunteer work almost entirely on that church. Of course, since then, we have built Bradley Hall, and now the new educational building. So we have quite a plant now, and our membership number is somewhat over 500. So we've seen a lot of changes in our own church life and in the church life of other churches in the community. Because when 50 years ago there was just our Long Hill Church, Methodist Church, and the Little St. Stephen's Church, which was such a sweet little church and only held about 100. It was on the same location as the present St. Stephen's Church, and there was the Episcopal Church, and then in Cashway, of course, there was the Episcopal Church there. The churches were not as numerous as they are today, but you know, we had a lot of fun in our churches then, and the focal point of interest was there, and we all enjoyed it very, very much. And I'm sure that I speak for many of you when I say that, for you too have enjoyed the church in the days gone by.
I think that's true. When your whole life revolves around the church, I really think those are really better days. Tell me, Mr.
Chairman, I didn't realize
there were so many cigars back in
your house. Do
you remember why
I was driving over? Well, I think I said over at your house that there were six, but I think I can only count five. There was the Gabler Cigar Factory, Mahoney's, Jennings and Hall, Levitt, and Nick Robb had a cigar factory mm-hmm. one time. But some of the local people worked in the cigar factories, but Gabler's factory in particular was employed mostly transients. And those fellows they'd stay a while, and they got money enough to go on a toot, and then they wouldn't be around for a while. And sure, we had one fellow in particular in town who used to do that same thing, but he was perfectly harmless. Everyone knew him, but he'd go on a toot and he'd be wandering around all night long and so forth. And there was a woman who lived alone near Gabler's factory there. And this fellow was on a toot. He was out in the backyard one night, and so she didn't want him out there. So she went out in the night and with a shotgun and fired it off. She thought she'd scare him away. And he says, Miss A. She didn't say anything. He says, Miss A. He says, you better put that thing away before you blow your darn head off. This same fellow one night, I recall, a knock on our door about 2 o'clock in the morning, and my father answered the door, and he says, could you give a fellow a cold potato? And, you know, he probably hadn't had any. He didn't know what time it was, whether it was night or day or what it was. We had several of those characters around town, but they were perfectly harmless. Well, I don't know unless you want me to say something about Paul Rock. Well, possibly Merrill knows more about it than I do because he's been collecting things and I heard my father tell about it. It was, I don't know when it started, but I know it was in operation in the beginning of the 19th century. About that time, 1878. Well, it must have been about 1899 when my mother had a tintype taken with me in her arms up there. So, I don't know much about it other than what my father had told me about the times they had up there. I know that there was a grove of hemlocks up there, a beautiful grove of hemlocks and maple trees, which were cut down for firewood during the coal strike back around 1916-17, when wood was at a premium. So there's nothing much up there now but small trees and brush. There was one building that I do recall was a skating rink. And later that was taken down and reassembled at the corner of Brooklawn Avenue and Capitol Avenue. It was the Brooklawn Dance Hall. In fact, I went there once or twice to dance. And then Barry and McCormick took it out and by Ash Creek, and it's what was the Ritz until now it's a furniture store, I believe. At Parlor Rock is located, somebody asked me where Parlor Rock was. Parlor Rock is located about midway between Whitney Avenue and the Mine Park, and on the west side of the Pequannock River. The railroad track went by there. In fact, the park was owned by the New York New Haven Hartford Railroad. And they used to bring people there by the trainload. Different church organizations and so forth would make up a trainload of people to come there for picnics. That's what it was noted for mostly. There were two ponds there, which I think were constructed originally to store water for three factories that were run by water power further down the river. And I know they had boats on the pond. And when I was about 6 years old, I guess, there were some people up there. The park had been closed at that time. There were some people up there. They got a hold of a boat and went out there, and three or four of them got drowned. So they blew the dams up and did away with the ponds.
Did your father ever take that
to Bobby? I don't even know whether there was one there or not. There might have been. I don't recall. There was? Well, then, probably. I know there was a shooting gallery up there. I heard him tell about that and some of those things. I don't just look at. Huh? You know, don't you? Well, down you can. Well, I know too, but I don't know. He may correct me. I may be wrong. But down at the south end, there is a projection of the ledge, and down underneath there's a shelf there. They call that the parlor, and that's how they named it, the Parlor Rock. I don't know whether they ever had a tea room down there or what, but there's quite a level rock there, and the ledge overhangs.
If we wanted to walk up there on Sunday afternoon, maybe Mr. Beecher could help. How would just take the children? I know nothing's there now. Where would you walk to from the house?
Well, I think the best way to approach it would be to go up to Old Mine Park and park your cars there, and then walk down about 5 minute walk or less. Be on your left going south.
Walk down the old railroad track.
You think so?
Yeah, walk down the old railroad track.
Plenty of parking.
There used to be a footbridge across the railroad track, and over on the other side was a baseball field. In fact, they used that baseball field for Industrial League games up until 1920. They used to play baseball up there.
When your folks and
Dorothy
used to go to St. Mary's by the sea after
hay
season.
Oh, that is right. Of course, in the olden days when the farmers used to get in their hay, and of course the school children, when they were home from school, would help them, and getting in the hay, filling the barns, was a big thing. And then you always had like a holiday. And the neighbors around our area used to go down to St. Mary's by the Sea. Probably you folks know where St. Mary's by the Sea is. It's the inlet down near, Black Rock down there near Ash Creek. And there's a very bad current down there, incidentally, and a lot of people have been drowned there. And there was an old church down there that, as they say, they've had a few services and it was all closed up. Well, years ago, my sisters and brother, they used to go down in the wagon, but by the time it came around to my time, we had a Model T Ford. And we used to go down to St. Mary's by the sea and have our family picnic down there. And in those days, we'd say in the 20s, or even around 1920, there didn't seem to be anybody at all around. You'd be there all day long, and you'd take something to eat down there. And of course, we dug clams and spent a day in
watermelon,
sure. And then we'd take a little dip, but we didn't have any bathing suits. We just had our old farm pants or denim, you know, and we'd walk in the water and thrash around a little bit, and we thought we had a wonderful time. And a lot of the people did the same thing at that time, and I guess that was how you used to enjoy yourself in those days.
It always had to be after hay season, isn't that right,
George? It was around August, yeah.
Now, you're holding something very precious there. What is it?
Well, I didn't intend to say anything about these, but there's one of these report cards of mine that's very interesting. I had got them in school, and I never thought anything more about them until my mother sent them up to me after I got married.
See, I wouldn't save mine like that.
Well, here's a report card. I get, G was for good, E was for excellent, and U was unsatisfactory, P poor, F failure. And written tests in percentage. So on arithmetic, I got good and good, and G minus and good until then. Then at the end of the year, I got 84. So good wasn't too much. And the rest of them is all good. Everything on this is good. And geography, I got myself E's. I think I got straight E's, excellent, which is excellent in geography, all the way to the end of the year, and I got 85. History, I got G. Well, I get them doing better in history right along. I get a G plus, then a G again, and I go up to G plus in the last 2 months. I got excellent. Get 85. So then it comes down to spelling. I get G, straight G's. Well, I got one G minus and one G, two G pluses. And then I failed. Here's the cards if you want to look at them.
I was kind of holding out a bit, hoping that David Wakely would come back, because this is his story, and I just think it's really kind of cute. I don't know if I can do it justice. Remember, it's very old. It was his wife's grandmother, grandfather. And this was read at the Grange. You can see the color of the paper and everything. And if I can get the whole story, but I just thought it was too cute to pass by, but I really wanted him to read it. This says, "A true story of much stickiness. Give me a sheet of poison fly paper," said a gray-eyed man to the clerk in the drugstore. And this is a true story. "Did you ever try the sticky kind?" asked the clerk. "Try it," snapped the man. "I should say I had, and I would not have a sheet of that fly paper in the house if the flies were as thick as the grasshoppers in Kansas." "What's the matter with it?" asked the clerk. "We sell 100 sheets to one of any other kind because it's not poisonous and there's no dead flies dropping around." "Well," answered the man, "it's just this way. Last September, when the weather was hot and the flies were thick, I conceived the idea one Saturday that I might take a bath. The house in which I lived had no bathroom, and any member of the family desires to indulge in this luxury, he or she must bring in a wash tub into the kitchen after the rest of the family have retired. On the night in question, after scrubbing to my heart's content, I proceeded to rub and dry myself thoroughly, and still clad in nature's own garb, I stepped into the dining room, which was dark, and I sat down in a chair near the open window to rub my feet and my ankles. When I arose from the chair, I found I had sat down on a sheet of very sticky fly paper.
I started to pull it off. I took hold of one corner, and I pulled as long as I could stand it. I then let go and pulled from the other corner and found that the first resumed its original position. And then I was as bad off as if I stood behind myself, I might have ripped it off, but as you would a plaster. Unfortunately, I wasn't built that way. I thought once that I would call my wife, but I know if I did, she would sit down and laugh until the tears came down. I did not feel like being laughed at this time. So I had another scheme. Pulling off one corner, I backed up to the kitchen door and shut the corner in it, and I gave a jerk and was free. And the flesh, pesky thing, from the pesky thing, and the perspiration was oozing from every pore. Next, I took the Turkish towel and proceeded to rub off what failed to come with the paper. And then found myself firmly attached to the towel. And once more, I submitted myself to the kitchen door for delivery of scratching myself in vain. So there must be some way to get this off. I tried sand soap, only to get it in a worse mess. What should I do? The only thing that I presented myself to mind was to take a flying trip across the fields to the sawmill and ask my friend Ed to turn on the emery wheel and shave it off. And then a bright thought came to me. I would try some kerosene. If that failed, I would apply a piece of paper. Paper over the place and go to bed. I found a kerosene can and a rag, and I began the process of removal. It worked like a charm. In a few moments, the sticky stuff was off, and after washing my hands, I retired and was soon in a nice deep sleep. How long I slept, I cannot tell you, but I dreamed I was in a place of lost souls, and a big flame was shooting out on my leg. Great Scott, that kerosene was getting in deadly work. And I had gone to sleep on my back, and as the bed warmed up, so did the kerosene, until I was hotter than the proverbial pepper plaster. I turned my burning anatomy out of the bed, thinking the cool night air would relieve me. But alas, it grew hotter every minute. I was obliged then to awaken my wife and explain the situation. She arose, and between sweet cream, talcum powder, soda, and etc., finally succeeded in rendering my more comfortable. And then we sat down and laughed. No siree, none of that sticky stuff in our house. And that's from David Wakely.
Miss Lindley, you had a couple more things you were going to tell us. Would you like to about the water?
Yes, I liked about the water.
Around 1918 or 19, the White Plains School was only two rooms. The owner of the property at the west corner of the school grounds objected to the children using a well there that had been used for ages for the school water supply. Water to drink really posed a real problem. Sunken wells were the only means of water in this area at this time. And Mr. C.C. Wells offered the school water from his own well, which he had dug himself. Mr. Knight, then the state supervisor, had samples of the water taken, and they were found very satisfactory. And this proved to be a very welcome source of water. The school board purchased two red paper mache white porcelain lined water coolers, the hand fill type. Each morning, Clifford Wells, then a student at the school, filled 2 5-gallon bottles of water, and later a third one when the annex was built, put them in his express wagon and hauled them from his house to the school. And with mighty heaves, believe me, they were heavy, heaved them up into the coolers. Flat wax paper cups were supplied for use. The jars were returned each day, and Mrs. Wells saw that each one of them was cleaned and ready for the next day.
In bad winter cold and snow and ice and rain, this was indeed a task. When it is realized that this service was given continuously for 7 or 8 years by the Wells family, you can readily see how much people in the community were indebted to them for their kindness. Mr. Clifford Wells tells me he still has the express wagon in his possession.
Another thing, while you're still talking, I think so many times that we all get involved in PTA and schoolwork and church work, and once in a while we get a little bit over our head. But I don't think I'm ever going to complain again when I heard Miss Lumen tell the story about how they wanted a piano.
Oh, no.
Oh, that was cute. Did you write that one down?
I think I did.
I was going to give you a lemon. I thought that would really start you off.
Well, this is the story about piano. In 1919, as Christmas time drew near, a directive was received by each teacher requesting appropriate exercises for the Christmas season, song, play, or other offerings. We did our best to have each child have some part in the program. Our piano was a large, old-fashioned one, a grand, and had been rather neglected. Certain notes had no sound at all, while others issued a sort of a fuzzy, blurred noise. It was very embarrassing, but we did our best. After the program, Mrs. Alfred D. Guyon, Sr. said, "We'll have to do something about that piano. If we want to teach our children to sing correctly and well, we should have the best instrument we can get." First, she asked for donations, but she received none. So on fine Saturdays, towards the end of the school year, Mrs. Guyon and I made homemade lemonade, which we sold at the edge of the school grounds and near the Broadbridge Light now at the Beardsley Park Golf Course at 10 cents a glass until we realized $100 in proceeds, net proceeds. I would attend to the sales while she took her car to bring fresh supplies. Eventually, we were able to purchase our needed piano. There's a little amusing story in connection with this venture. One very warm afternoon, a police officer of Bridgeport approached our table and he said, "Ladies, how's lemonade?" Mrs. Stein said, "Fine. Would you like a glass?" To which he replied, "I don't mind if I do. It's a long, hot walk down here." After he finished, he said, "Do you ladies have a permit to sell here?" "Oh, no," Mrs. Guyon said. "We're only trying to earn money enough for piano for our school. One or two more Saturdays should see the end." "Oh, I see," said. "Well, now, you're really on the outside of this fence, and you're really not in the park, and you're really not selling for your own profit. I'll say I investigated and I found no irregularities."
I wonder how many lemons it's
clear. Oh,
that can of concentrate and fill it up with water. And those are fresh lemons.
Especially.
Now, does anybody else have a little story? See if I'm right on this one of David Wakeley's, because I just loved a few of his stories. I was going to bring this picture to see if it reminded him. There was a man in town, and he, I guess he imbibed quite often, and he got kind of difficult at times. And he went in the house one day, and they said that all good farmers had cider, and I guess he kept his cider so it was real good. And one day he took his wife's good cut glass pitcher, and he had already had too much already, but he was going down the cellar for just a little bit more. And he fell down the cellar stairs, and she came in. She said, John, he said, "Don't worry, I'm not hurt." She said, "How about the pitcher?" So he hadn't broken the pitcher, but when he heard that, he smashed it against the cellar wall. Now, is there anything else anybody wants to tell, or anybody in the audience would like to tell us a story or two? I bet you could.
When we were building our church,
This was on a Saturday. Yes, Lawrence was there. He knows it. Well, it was on a Saturday, and the ladies were fixing lunch and trying to help all they could, and it was a hot day. And Howard and Dorothy's father was helping, as he always did so faithfully. And he was just so hot, and he just wanted a drink of something so badly, so the ladies made some lemonade. I didn't have a hand in this, so I'm glad I didn't. And they fixed this lemonade and brought it out, and it looked so nice, and Mr. Seeley said, oh, just give me a glass of that. So they handed him a glass. He was so thirsty, he started to drink it, got it partly down, and instead of sugar, someone had put salt in the lemonade. So you know how much he enjoyed it. Of course, they made some more, but I can remember that.
I drank some of it.
Oh, did you?
I was going to pass a picture around. I just thought you would like to look at it. And this is a flag owned by Mrs. German on Rocky Ridge Drive in Nichols. And I really think it's the most beautiful thing. She tells that it was a Civil War flag, and it flew on the green at Long Hill. And as far as she knows about it, the ladies who worked on it, but again, she said, you know, you might leave out a name or two, but Mrs. Frederick Turney, Mrs. Walter Havely, and Hawley, and Mrs. Elliot Beardsley. It's really a most magnificent thing, and I think someday it will be marvelous if the Historical Society could exhibit something like this. So I wish you would look at the picture. Mr. Beach has taken it, and it's really, it's huge, and of course it's handmade, and I think it's something that it's just worth seeing, even the picture on it. Now, is there any other stories anyone would like to tell? Mr. Cooper, you don't have a story. Actually, you know, I have to tell a little bit on, I still call my boss, because I worked for Cooper's Florist for 20 years, and this is where this kind of originated, when we used to get very tired holidays down the store, and Mr. Cooper would kind of pep us up with some of the stories that happened in Trumbull, and I think this is where this idea began, because I always used to love to hear him tell about the cows getting away and everything, and I thought, this is what people are going to miss. And so maybe we could do this again sometime in the Historical Society. I'd like to thank particularly Dorothy Seeley. She was a great help to me, and Barbara Condon for her help and advice on getting this program together. Thank you very much, everyone.